Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
And good evening to you, and welcome to KZSC Santa Cruz, UCSC. I'm your host, John Sandage. It is the Talk About Show. Dr. Dawn Motyka is with me in the studios. Hiya, Dawn.
How are you doing?
I was a little shaky earlier in the afternoon, but things are great now. And I appreciate you coming down tonight. She's going to be with us for the full hour and a half. So we'll be talking about a lot of things, medical and health issues. And one of the big ones in the Monterey Bay right now, Dr. Dawn, is the smoke.
Indeed, I've been seeing a lot of patients who are having real trouble with it. Many of my patients have environmental sensitivities that are a little greater than most of us, but, you know, it's always a bell curve. And asthmatics, people with COPD, they're having a really hard time. People with allergies are showing up in my office with flares of their allergies because the smoke is an irritant.
Yeah, well, like tobacco, or I guess even cannabis. That's part of one of the problems with cannabis. Not a very big one, but it's one of them.
Well, it depends on how you consume it. I mean, if you burn it, then you've got combustion products, which is not the THC and the CBD. Those actually come off at a lower temperature, hence the vaporizers.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, what do we do about what can people do? Is there anything you can do short of wearing a mask wherever you go?
Well, the first thing is don't exercise outside unless you're right on the coast and the wind is blowing inland from the Pacific, and then you're probably all right. But the winds are a little bit unpredictable, and so use your nose for starters. And if you can smell any smoke at all or anything along those lines, you probably don't want to be exercising outside, particularly aerobic type exercise. I mean, if you're stretching or walking, that's one thing. But if you're pulling in a lot of air, burning a lot of oxygen, then you're also sucking in a lot of pollutants. Second thing is indoor air quality. Tricky, but if you have filters, if you have a HEPA filter, turn that on.
What is a HEPA filter?
It's a high... I don't know what the initials stand for. I don't recall. But it's essentially a very low permeability filter, so it pulls the small particles out of the atmosphere. So it'll get like mold spores out of the atmosphere. Oh. So it's a very good thing to have around.
Well, it's going to be harder on the lungs in the southern part of the bay as opposed to the Santa Cruz northern part of the bay.
Well, it kind of depends on which way the wind is blowing. And again, there's a bell curve. I'm not a meteorologist, but it seems like there's something about the wind patterns in the bay that create these sort of little concentrated local pockets, vortices of some kind. And there are areas that really have problems.
So how do you treat patients?
Well, generally what you're doing is think of this as an irritant that what happens when you get irritated. And in a given patient, that could be an asthma attack. That could be increased mucus production with a cough. That could be simply increased respiratory rate, which in some individuals, because they have a problem extracting oxygen from the air, this is people with emphysema. They will breathe faster trying to get more oxygen, but that will also get them more particulates. And it's largely the particulates that cause the problems.
Yeah.
They actually think of them kind of like a hot spark coming off of a campfire. You know, it's going to land somewhere and sizzle a little bit. And in that sort of thing can set a fire, but more often it just burns a little hole in your shoe.
Yeah.
And
the particulates we're breathing in are not, at least up at this end, at the Santa Cruz end of the bay, are not going to be hot like that.
No. Well, they're going to be, it's a metaphor. So they're going to have a kind of chemical sizzle.
I see. Okay. I thought, boy, and all the way up here, how are they going to still be hot?
No.
Okay. And are you having, are the people happy with the treatment? I mean, can they function, or are they really sort of stuck inside?
Depends on the patient and how severe their compromise is.
Yeah.
And this is all about resilience. And some of us are already walking around half inflamed, so it doesn't take much to create a real inflammatory storm. And that's kind of an avalanche of chemical signals that each one sort of calls to the other. For example, there's this thing called interleukins, and there's about a dozen of these, and one of them will call certain type of white blood cells to an area. One of them will cause another type of white blood cell to start dividing and making more antibody. Another interleukin might actually turn down the immune system. So there's this big chemical dialogue going on. And we actually have two inflammatory agents. We have the prostaglandins, which is what your Motrin and your ibuprofen and your naproxen block. And then we have our leukotrienes, which cause a long-term swelling and congestion. And those are blocked by drugs like montelukast, which is singular. A lot of asthmatics and people with allergies are taking that once-a-day pill to keep those symptoms at bay. It's particularly good for congestive symptoms. Another thing people can do if you don't want to use pharmaceuticals is physically cleaning out your nasal passages with a neti pot. So using a salt water wash.
You mean that old-fashioned?
That very, very old-fashioned snort the salt water thing actually has some legitimacy. And the thing that it's doing is these leukotrienes that I mentioned earlier have a very long half-life. Now, when I release histamine gets broken down in the body fairly quickly. There's a couple of enzymes, DAO in the gut, and I forget the name of the one in the nose, but they see this molecule, which is very powerful, potent inflammatory molecule, and that causes blood vessels to leak. And so histamine gives you hives, and it gives you a runny nose, and it gives you itchy, watery eyes. And if you let that accumulate, you could get very, very sick, even go into shock. So our body breaks down that histamine very quickly. But the leukotrienes don't get broken down quickly. So they can hang around and do damage for days. So washing them out kind of attenuates the reaction.
And you can buy those devices at
health food stores, drug stores now. They're pretty much all over the place. And in a pinch, a good old-fashioned turkey baster.
Shooting it up the nose.
$1 at the dollar store will do the job.
All right. 459-4036 is our number. If you have questions or want to join in the conversation, we'd love to have you join us. That's why we're here tonight. 459-4036. Another thing that's in the air that we don't see, and I was just watching a show about, there's a town where they have no cell phones and no towers and is it radio waves or some kind of way of what those towers put off that affect people?
Mm-hmm. Well, EMF is usually the electromagnetic frequencies, and in these cases with cell phones and Wi-Fi, we're in the microwave zone, which is considered a non-ionizing radiation because it's not powerful enough to damage DNA.
So, but there are people that are affected by this.
Yes, and again, you're talking about a bell curve of response. How shall we know who's going to be affected by this and who's not, except that there are people who will get a headache when they're in a high EMF field? And it's been a long haul actually convincing people that this is a thing, because there's a great many people with a lot of skin in the game who have a strong interest in believing it's not a problem, like all of the cell phone companies.
Yes.
and, you know, large chunks of the government. There's an old saying by Mark Twain, which is, it's very difficult to convince a man of something if his paycheck depends on him not believing it. And so that's our situation.
Like a tobacco executive?
Like a tobacco executive. And there's a great deal of data on what these EMF fields do. And there's animal data. There's, you know, a lot of evidence about cell phones. But, you know, people really just don't want to accept it. And there are many people who are fine. There are many people who are not. And so we are engaging in a colossal, uncontrolled experiment on ourselves to see what happened. And I hope it won't turn out to be that, like those Romans who got the really bright idea of the lead pipes from the aqueduct, because, hey, lead's great. You know, it's soft. You can shape it. It's wonderful for plumbing. There's just a small problem with lead. What did we have in the French Revolution? Ladies painted a lead oxide on their faces to get that lovely white color that was so fashionable at the time. But they were giving themselves lead poisoning.
Isn't it crazy? That's just crazy stuff.
Well, they didn't know. Well, and the course, question is, what you don't know can kill you or injure you. I'm not saying that, you know, the current increase in autism or ADD or la-la-la is due to electromagnetic fields. I'm not saying that. What I am saying, though, is if you take your cell phone and you leave it on and you put it on over a plate of sperm and you have another cell phone that is off sitting on another petri dish full of sperm, you'll see a decline in motility, a more rapid decrease in movement, in other words, of the sperm near the cell phone than the ones who are near the cell phone that is off. And that's a nice blind, and that's a nice controlled study that says, well, gee, these microwaves that radiate out of this thing are doing something. And there are studies looking at male fertility. You know, if you're trying to get pregnant, with your partner, obviously, and not being successful, you might want to take the cell phone out of the front pocket. You know, it's like the old boxer short things.
Yeah.
And part of the problem there is that sperm are very sensitive to heat, and the cell phones actually do heat up adjacent tissues. Microwave towers back in World War II, people used to just take their lunch and stick it on the transmitter and it would heat it up. And that's how the microwave oven was actually thought of, was that,
oh, is that
the
right?
People
that's
who were in these really high EMF situations near transmitters way back then figured out that, hey, we're heating up things and everyone practically has a microwave. And you know how they sort of heat up the wet stuff, but not the solid stuff.
Yeah.
It takes much, much longer. And it's causing the molecules to move. It's molecular heating. Well, if we can molecularly heat things and we're holding that phone up to our ear, you can measure warming of that side of the skull.
Yeah. We all tend to hold it to one side or another, you know, mm-hmm. somebody, if you're left-handed or right-handed, depending where you're going to hold it up.
Oddly enough, and I've actually broken myself of this habit because right-hand dominant people usually hold their cell phones to their right ear. I am right-hand dominant, but I am almost always, when I'm on my cell phone, if I'm holding it up to my ear, I'm writing down things. So I hold it up to my left ear. So
it has this great thing. You can put it on speakerphone.
Well, my speaker.
I mean, this is for not just you.
No.
I mean, I don't think people think of that a lot. If you're worried about that, and we should be, mm-hmm. then there's a way around it. You can keep it further away from your head by just using your speakerphone and letting everybody share in your secrets.
Well, there's the fact that I'm talking to patients,
yes.
So there's a certain privacy issue there. But no, I have a headset that I plug in with. It has a microphone on the thing, and that's much better. I try not to hold it up to my ear, but sometimes, you know, I'm out and about and I don't have my headset, and so there we are. Another thing around cell phones that I always want to put out there is their effect on mitochondria.
On who?
Mitochondria. Do you know what a mitochondria is?
I don't.
Well, allow me to elucidate. Okay, mitochondria are our cells' energy factories, and they're these very, very important little structures inside every cell. They're one of a bunch of little molecular machines called organelles. In the case of mitochondria, we actually think that mitochondria once upon a time were similar to blue-green algae. They were free, living, independent bacteria, and that they actually migrated into eukaryotic cells. They're only found in eukaryotic cells, that is to say, cells with a nucleus. Bacteria don't have a nucleus. And the eukaryotic cells are what make up our body, and it's also what makes up the parasites. Malaria, for example, is a eukaryotic cell. A lot of the best parasites are eukaryotes. And these mitochondria provide, it's kind of like the lichen. You have moss and you have, what is lichen? It's algae and fungi together. And they sort of help each other out. They're a symbiotic relationship. Well, the mitochondria take the two carbon fragments that we hand them, and they generate a truckload of energy out of it, whereas bacteria can only get 8 molecules of ATP, 6 to 8, out of a two-carbon fragment. A properly functioning mitochondria can get something like 28 to 32.
Big difference.
400% difference. I mean, that's a substantial evolutionary advantage. So mitochondria were a good idea, and they allowed for the creation of multiple-celled organisms, because prior to that, the bacteria, they're single-celled. There are no there are no groups of bacteria except colonies, and they would grow in these big flat discs called stromatolites that look kind of like hassocks. You know, the ottomans or hassocks. Mm-hmm. They just sort of sit there right at the ocean shore barrier and grow, and that was the most advanced form of life before multicellular life came along. And the mitochondria revolution is, you know, why we're here today. And we all carry these mitochondria, and we get them all from our mom. So one of
is
the,
that through the birth canal? Is
no,
that
it's
one
through
of those?
The egg.
Oh, okay. Because there's been this talk now a lot more about the birth canal for bacteria.
Exactly. Well, this is an order of magnitude lower. We're down inside the cell now, and the mom's DNA from her cell, from the cytoplasm, those are her mitochondria. Those are what we get. So the sperm doesn't carry any mitochondria. Sperm's just along for the ride. And it's a hell of a ride for the sperm, but it doesn't in the end result in transmission of that type of genetic information, which is, you know, interesting, because they've been able to trace all of humanity back to a single sort of female who lived in Africa, and I forget the date, but it's, you know, somewhere in the 50,000 years ago, I believe, if I'm not off by an order of magnitude, which is entirely possible in this matter, is this one Eve who is essentially the mother of all of our mitochondria.
Boy, the research and the people who find these things, it must be sort of thrilling when whoever discovered that the first time, however they discovered it, to say, oh, look, we've got, well, what do we call it? How about mitochondria?
We scientists get excited about the craziest stuff.
Well, that's why there's so few of you compared to the population. It's a confusing and a hard thing. You have to really have a mind that can put all that kind of stuff together, and so it becomes, and not all of us are fortunate enough to have that. Give us a hand here. We're doing a talk show, and we need your help. So if you got any questions or comments, that's what we do here on Wednesday evenings on the Talk About Show. And while you're considering that, all of that, when you were talking about the things that harm us is tanning couches. Now, that looked to me, and I've seen shows and read articles about them, that's just a really foolish thing to do.
Well, under most circumstances, I think it really is. There would be, if you are unable to get outside and unable to get sun, and for whatever reason your GI tract is unable to absorb vitamin D as a supplement, then you need vitamin D. So it's what I would advise people to do is like 5 minutes in a tanning booth daily or something like that, because it's a pretty powerful dose of UV radiation, and you don't want to get to the point of a burn ever. And a small incremental dose would be something I have, in fact, recommended to people who are having problems absorbing vitamin D. I have said, okay, use a tanning bed, but here's your protocol. You know, you're going in there for 3 minutes on the first day, 4 minutes on the next day. And the way tanning beds work, of course, you're paying for a 15 or a half, a 15-minute interval, so it gets expensive to do it right. But you don't want to jump the gun. You're not trying to lay down a tan. You're trying to get that vitamin D going, which is very important.
Yeah, well, you can take the pill, but if you can't absorb it, then it doesn't do you any good. Hi, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
I've got a quick question for Dr. Don.
Okay.
First thing I want to say, Dr. Don is taking care of my mid-80-year-old parents who are just getting ready to go on a little vacation right now. So Dr. Don's been helping them out for quite a while. And but we have never met. But I'm calling in to ask you, because I've surfed in the local area for about 50 years, and I'm almost 60, and I just, the last couple of years, got a little bit of that dirty water, I guess, maybe packed way up high in my sinuses.
Mm.
And you were talking about, you know, the sinus rinse and the of course, the neti pot. And I'm just wondering, is there any other little things? I've got something on my left side, above my left eyeball, up in that pocket up there. And, man, it just won't go away. And when the pressure changes, the pressure I can feel when a different, you know, the fogs, either real thick clouds are coming in, I get a real heavy pressure on that side. Is there something that I could do to rinse that out or get that out of there other than a doctor offered me Flonase, and I said I just didn't think that that was where I wanted to go. I haven't had to take anything like that ever.
What is Flonase?
Flonase is fluticasone. It's a steroid. And it's a good one. I use it a lot for allergies, and it's going to take down swelling, anti-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. So it's a reasonable suggestion for the doctor to make. However, it is also it also takes down the immune system. So if you're trying to fight off an infection, it may be a little bit of a double-edged sword. Now, this pressure that you're feeling when you say this pocket, we're not talking about something you can see. This is something that you're sensing on the inside, the nose side of your eyeball, right?
Yeah. This is just my physical diagram of kind of the sinuses themselves up above my eyeball.
Right. So up above your eyeball, directly above your eyebrow, is the frontal sinus. And then between your two eyeballs, you have the ethmoid and the sphenoid sinuses. And then underneath, you have the maxillary sinus under your eye. So all of these sinuses are there, among other things, to lighten the weight of your head. But they also create resonance chambers, and they help. And the nose, of course, is there to heat the air and aerate the air that you're breathing, so that you're not cooling down your core temperature, you know, with what comes in through your mouth. So getting back to your question, if you've got an infection, and in your situation, I don't know if you've got an infection or just a blockage. So I always start with drainage. If you've got a boil, you have to lance it. So in this case, there's an agent. It's over the counter. It's called guaifenesin, G-U-A-I-F-E-N-E-S-I-N. And this stuff is a goo thinner. So you've got goo up there. We're going to make the goo thinner. So you would take guaifenesin, you would drink a lot of water, and you would steam. So a big bowl of boiling water, and get a towel and make a kind of sauna tent. Or if your significant other has a facial sauna device, sometimes people still have those kicking around. They were all the rage about when the 80s. So if you're in your 60s, there may be one in there may be one in the back of your bathroom closet that you don't know about.
I'm pretty much a towel guy over the hot water, but that'll be great.
All right, so do that. And then the sinus lavage that we were talking about is also helpful, but in that location, if it's the frontal or the ethmoid sinus, then the steam is going to stand a better chance of getting up there, because obviously steam rises. And that one is step one. Now, if you think you've got an infection, there's a couple of other things that might be helpful. And for surfers, I generally have my surfers do colloidal silver, which is a sort of all-purpose bacterial killer. And the bacteria that are out there in our ocean because of the, you know, because of overflow and spillages, there's a lot of coliforms, a lot of gram-negative bacteria that are kind of poop bugs. And those will get up into the sinuses and build themselves a nice little environment called a biofilm. So one last natural medicine trick when I'm having real trouble clearing one of these is not only will I have the people be doing the steams and the guaifenesin and the colloidal silver, but I'll also have them pick up, we call them digestive enzymes, and they're basically proteases. They break down proteins, and they help target those biofilms. Think of a coral reef, right? So you can take a dead coral reef and you can seed it with little bits of coral, and if the ocean environment is adequately clean, those little bits of coral will actually reseed and regrow into the coral reef. So the biofilm is dead, but it's a structure that the bacteria can live in. And so you want to disrupt that biofilm. I know. Think about flossing, right? When you floss your teeth, you're disrupting the biofilm that forms. And that biofilm, the plaque, we have to eventually go and get chipped off our teeth because no matter how diligent we are with our brush, we don't have the ability to completely clean them. And so eventually they build up this biofilm and we have to chip it off.
Okay, okay. So what was the final number three after colloidal silver
so,
for that?
So that's these digestive enzymes.
Okay,
so
and
you
are
get
they,
them.
Are we talking like Wobe enzyme?
Wobe enzyme would be a good one. Yeah, that's exactly. Okay. So these are generally vegetarian enzymes. They've got bromelain, they've got papain, right. Et cetera, et cetera. And right. You want to take 5-6 capsules between meals. So it has to be on an empty stomach, and you take a lot of it. And I do not understand exactly what's going on physiologically, but I've used it in recalcitrant sinuses, and I've used it for prostatitis that I've been wrestling with for months with patients, and they get better.
Okay, and so the Wobe, you like that? You like that one?
I think that's a good one.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's like it's the
so
granddaddy
meals,
of them all.
Of course, on an empty stomach, right? Mm-hmm. Colloidal silver. How? What do you do? Is that
comes in a spray?
So is that something I'm going to be taking orally, or is that something that goes up my
goes nose up your nose?
Or?
And what I would do is once you get this problem handled, you might want to use it a couple times a day until you get this problem handled. But once it's handled as a preventative, after you get out, you take off your wetsuit and you're getting ready to drive home and give yourself a blast in either nostril.
Right, of just the colloidal spray?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, okay. Yeah. And then how do you spell that first thing you gave me?
Guaifenesin?
Yeah.
Yeah, Guaifenesin.
Awesome. Thanks. All right, keep up the good work. Thanks for taking care of our elder folks here in the town, okay?
Thank you.
And thanks for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Does that, what you're talking about, does that work for post-nasal drip?
Well, it depends on why you have post-nasal drip.
Ah, okay.
And so if it's allergic, that fluticasone, take it right away for you.
All right.
And maybe even the neti pot.
I want to try a neti pot. I've never done that. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Yes, it's Terry Maxwell calling in.
Hey, Terry.
I know and respect Dr. Don highly.
Oh, well, how are you doing?
Fine. I hope you've been well, lady.
I have.
We must have lunch again with your lucky husband sometime soon.
That would be wonderful.
Okay. In the meanwhile, I am on my way to CVS to get a shingles shot.
Mm-hmm.
Having that diagnosed at a helpful lady named Cynthia Hill at PAMP with a rash, et cetera.
Now, when were you diagnosed?
In addition, Dawn, they suggested valacyclovir?
Yeah.
Valacyclovir.
Yes.
You are correct.
Yes.
Three times a day. So I just walked away from the pharmacy with that, and I'm headed back where they can give me a shingle shot. And I do have the symptoms on my chest and midsection and back.
Okay. I'm kind of not in favor of your getting this shot. I mean, and here's why.
Okay.
What is in that shingles shot is attenuated shingles virus, right? It is a virus that has been beaten up but not completely killed. And it's so weak that it's probably not going to give you chicken pox, except sometimes it will give the person who has not been vaccinated, who is around you after the shot, chicken pox. And this is particularly true. Some people will break out in a little bit of a chicken pox rash after the shot. And it sounds like you've already got the shingles rash.
Yes, ma'am.
So what you want to do
I did have chicken pox at age 10.
Right. And so what you want to do is treat what you've got right now with the antivirals.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're already getting an immune booster. As we speak, your immune system is seeing that virus because you're making it. You're making your own copies of that virus. See, it sits in your DNA, in your spinal column. It goes into hibernation, and every now and then it tries to wake up and break out, and the immune system swats it. And then one day the immune system is looking the other way, and it gets out, and it starts to multiply, and it climbs down the nerve. Remember that nerve from between your spinal column and your finger or your chest? That's one cell. I'm so amazed by that. A human cell that is 3 feet long, 36 inches
wow.
From your L5 to your foot, that's a single cell, one cell wall that's been stretched out 3 feet. And we think of cells as these tiny little things. But this is not a tiny little thing. So that's wild. And the fact that the virus can climb all the way down that and get to the surface of your skin where it essentially causes the rash, trying desperately to leap out of this body that has it locked up and jump to another fresh body so that it can fulfill its mission of infecting all of us with chickenpox. Because that is the mission of a virus, is to make as many copies of itself as possible. That's its programming.
Okay.
So what you want to do is wait and go look up the CDC recommendations for chickenpox or for this is Zostavax and go look it up. If I remember correctly, and I don't have my computer here today because I kind of showed up today thinking we were going to do a short show and discovered I was doing a long show. So I don't have my, you know, my lovely internet, my fingertips really. But I think it's a year after a bout of shingles before you're supposed to get the shot.
Okay.
So you might want to just, you know, take the pills, go look that up, see if I'm right, because I'm not 100% certain that they haven't changed this since the shot first came out. But it's my distinct recollection that the initial recommendations were wait a year after a bout of shingles before you do it.
Okay. But I'm impatient, Dr. Dawn.
I know that. And that's part of your charm. But on the other hand, it doesn't always work for you. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Very good.
And I did get very fatigued and tired working on a project around the clock the last week.
Mm-hmm.
So my immune system, for sure, people noticed I was looking haggard.
Right. Exactly.
Would that have brought this about, Doctor?
Absolutely. It's usually it's usually psychological stress, physiological stress, or an illness, so that the immune system is just chasing after something else so hard that the shingles kind of sneaks in through the side door.
Surely. Okay. Thank you for your wise wisdom.
And there's nothing like looking bad about looking like Merle Haggard. Hey, thanks for your call.
Be well, lady. Take care.
Bye-bye, Terry.
You are on the air with Dr. Don Motyka.
Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
I have a question about psoriasis.
Okay.
And I have significant joint inflammation and was wondering if there is a smart and effective way that I might be addressing that.
All right. Well, this is one of the relatively recent things that we've become aware of in medicine, let's say over the last 10 years or so, is how many people with psoriasis develop a psoriatic arthritis.
And what kind of arthritis? I've never heard that term.
Well, psoriatic means psoriasis-ic. So psoriasis-like arthritis. And there's a special brand of arthritis that people with psoriasis get. And this is back to those chemicals I was talking about, the leukotrienes and the other interleukins, which are the signaling molecules that control the immune system. Well, they go everywhere, right? They get into the bloodstream. You may have a problem locally on your elbow at your psoriatic patch, but the chemicals that are being excreted there, and secreted, I should say, by the cells that are attacking the skin, leading to the psoriasis, those chemicals get into your bloodstream, they get into your lymphatics, they go everywhere, and anywhere else where they're kind of like gasoline fumes, anywhere else there's a spark of inflammation, they'll amplify it, they'll be an accelerant for it. And people with psoriasis have they have an almost rheumatoid arthritis-like immune attack on their joints as well as on the surface of their skin. And in a functional medicine, and functional medicine is systems biology, if you haven't heard that term before. So in a functional medicine, we take a slightly different tactic from conventional. So let me give you the conventional medicine spiel on this. What we're going to do in conventional medicine is we're going to block tumor necrosis alpha, and this is an one of those inflammatory signals that upregulates the immune system, and we're going to block it with monoclonal antibodies. Or we're going to give you Plaquenil, or we're going to give you methotrexate. Both of these are, Plaquenil was developed to treat, to kill malaria, and methotrexate was developed to kill cancer. And both of these are toxic to rapidly dividing cells, which when your immune system is stimulated, that's your immune system. So you can block the immune system in a kind of global way with these agents. And the upside of that is that you calm down the immune system's attack on itself, which is awesome. The downside of it is that you actually mess up your immune system, and so your risk of cancer, particularly blood cancers like leukemia, goes up when you use some of these drugs long term. And then the Plaquenil and methotrexate have liver toxicity, so these are pretty heavy agents. Often what I'll do with psoriasis, is I'll step back and look at the patient, and this is now we're moving into functional medicine, and say, all right, why is their immune system so upregulated? Why are they so inflamed? That should be damping down if the system were functioning normally. And one of our truisms is that if it's not damping down, then the brake must be flawed. And the brake, largely for the immune system, is the intestine. And the intestine contains the vast majority, more like 70 to 75% of our immune cells are wrapped around our gut, keeping all the bacteria and stuff that we ingest every day from invading our bloodstream and killing us. And our immune system is very good at that. But if you don't have the right dialogue going on between the internal bacteria, interior bacteria of the gut, and the immune system, then the immune system gets out of hand. There's this sort of modulation that occurs from the microbiome. And so we try to fix the microbiome in people with psoriasis. Another thing I try to do in people with psoriasis is increase their vitamin D levels. There's a drug that you can give that's basically just pure vitamin D topically. It's super expensive, which is kind of ridiculous when you think of it. It's like vitamin D. Why is it expensive? But that being said, it can be extremely effective for psoriasis if you can get your insurance to cover it.
But if it's vitamin D, can't you just get that vitamin D pill that you would ingest and break it open and rub it on the psoriasis?
It doesn't work, and I don't know the story on that. I don't know why that doesn't work.
Too bad.
You can take that vitamin D pill orally, and for anyone with any autoimmune disease, psoriasis included, I encourage you to get your level up to 70, which is a safe level, but most doctors consider...
What level of what?
Of vitamin D3 the bloodstream. So you can get a level of 70 by supplementing. Very hard to get a level of 70 with the sun unless you're walking around unless you're a lifeguard and you're out there with no sunscreen on and you're burnt a nice dark mahogany, and then you can probably if you started out as a white guy, you probably have enough vitamin D to be at 70. But for the most part, you need to supplement to achieve those levels. And I would encourage that because that modulates the immune system. I'd encourage having a functional medicine doctor look at your microbiome, maybe test it. We have genetic testing for it now, and see whether you have enough of the good bacteria or whether you have too many of the bad bacteria. Maybe work on that a little bit because that can make a big difference in these autoimmune conditions. And we just have scads of evidence that we can modify things. The Crohn's disease data, which is inflammatory bowel disease, your antibodies are attacking your skin and your joints. In Crohn's, they're attacking the lining of the bowel. So then the lining of the bowel becomes very inflamed. And if you put these modulating bacteria into the bowel, you calm down that fire. And you also calm down arthritis at a distance. So with with the same individuals. And we're not aiming at the arthritis, but we make it better anyway when we do the fecal transplants. But we can't do fecal transplants on everybody. This is a very new technology, and we're having trouble figuring out how to do it safely.
When you say fecal transplants, is that what I think it is?
There is one place in the country right now, they're in Boston, they are approved to supply clean poo. And they have poo donors who have been vetted for not having any of the diseases like hepatitis B or AIDS or anything else that you might be able to pick up through a stool transplant. And, of course, you always want your stool from a thin donor, not an obese donor, because their bowel flora is actually perpetuating their obesity, we now understand. And for people who have severe obesity, someday stool transplant may, in fact, be the treatment.
Stool transplant.
Yes, or it's, you know, sometimes called fecal transplant.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
You know, there's...
Same word.
I like to call them a poop... I call it a poo plant. A poo implant. Just because I
every
like
time
it.
You come here, I find something new that just throws me completely off.
So back to our
yes,
psoriasis
yes,
guy.
Sorry.
So what I would suggest you do is good, real clean diet. And lots of vegetables, lots of fiber, probiotics, prebiotics, fermented foods, and the vitamin D, and stop eating gluten. Just no wheat, no gluten, and dairy. Because if you just give up those two things for a couple of months and do the other things I've told you, you have a decent chance at backing this down. You aren't going to be cured, but it's like it'll give you back some of that normal breaking power that you're missing right now.
Fantastic. Thank you, both of you, for your time.
Thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hey, well, I got two. Thanks. I have a question because you brought up this whole electrical field topic a moment ago, which I appreciate very much. I don't know much about that. And I was wondering a little bit. I mean, I have these phenomena that are, for me, very, very evident. For example, the other day I was at a coffee house and they have these wireless charging stations. And I just had my hand on the table and all of a sudden my hand started to hurt. And I realized it was right on top of those charging stations.
Could I ask you to slow it down a little bit? Sir? Sir? Hello?
Yeah.
Could I ask you to slow it down a little bit? It's hard to understand.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking really fast.
Sorry,
you've been in the
that.
Coffee shop too long.
Anyway, I have lots of experiences with these electrical fields that you were talking about, and some of them are very clear to me. Others are kind of not so clear. And I was just wondering what you would suggest, basically, to the right amount of paranoia, basically, about these topics, because I could get myself very worried about these things, and I could also say, okay, it's all just imagination.
Right. And unfortunately, there is once you get a ghost in your head, you know, one is right. capable of auto-suggesting oneself into, you know, quite a corner, shall we say. So
right.
Here's something that will help. It's called the inverse square law. And this is a wonderful law of physics. And it says the power of any electromagnetic radiation will decline by the square of distance. So, for example, if I am 2 feet away, if I am touching something, then my power that I'm getting is 100. If I am 2 feet away from it, then it's now 100 divided by 4, or 2 squared. So now I'm getting a quarter the amount of the energy. If I'm 3 feet away from it, I'm getting a ninth the amount of energy, 3 squared, and so on. So if you can just find the Wi-Fi transmitter, so it does sound like you might be sensitive, particularly the thing about the hand makes me think you're sensitive. And what happened there was that, I think, is that your mitochondria were affected, and I'll explain that in a second. But anyway, find out where the transmitter is and get on the other side of the room. If you can put 6-7 feet between you and it, you've reduced your dose drastically. And so if you're in, you know, a coffee shop, that's your strategy, is to look for the area where the transmitter isn't. And that will help reduce your risk. Another thing those little things, I see people wearing little charms and holy medals and things that are supposed to attenuate the EMF. And there is literally no data supporting the use of those things. None whatsoever. And my attitude is, if you're going to charge people $30 for a device, you need to be able to show that there's at least, you know, something more than a bunch of people who hypnotize themselves into thinking it works. Because, you know, you spend the $30 and, yeah, I think it's working. Right? Because otherwise you blew away $30. So that's one thing. A second thing is, look for where your, I don't know what your dwelling is like, but look for sources of EMF in your dwelling. And there are people who will come with a meter, and you can buy a meter, but it's better to actually pay somebody $50 to come out and check for the hot spots. Because I had this done in my office, and I was really surprised, because there's a wall in the middle of my acupuncture office that doesn't look like anything, but it's got a lot of EMF in it. And the rest of the place is really clean. And so, and it's not clear, because it doesn't look like, it's an internal wall and doesn't look like a wall that you would run a lot of electrical stuff. And I went down to the cellar and I couldn't find a lot of wiring. So I have no idea why it's a hot wall, but it's, you know, very reproducible. The guy has the device. He goes up to my Wi-Fi and on my desk, and it lights, it shows this reading, and he goes around and checks all the other places. And essentially, anywhere there's electricity being used, anything pulling a lot of voltage, like a refrigerator, is going to generate an EMF field as well. So it doesn't just have to be Wi-Fi. So finding out where your hotspots are, and just not living next, and make sure your bed is not, you know, against a hot wall or something like that, seems prudent for a person who feels himself to maybe be sensitive. Now, other things that you should be doing, and this is getting back to the mitochondria, is you want to be doing mitochondrial support, because these, particularly microwaves, will breeze through these cells, these mitochondria. And the way mitochondria generate that energy is by creating a gradient called an electron gradient. And then they let the electrons drop one by one through the electron gradient, and they capture that energy of the drop. So it's an energy transduction. And when, as the electron drops in its field potential, you grab that energy and put it in an ATP, and then we send that ATP out to your brain or out to your index finger to, you know, dial your phone or whatever. But you use that energy. And we have, at any minute, at any moment in time, we have about 14 seconds of ATP in our body. That's it. So that's why cyanide kills you so quickly, is because it poisons the ATP generation process. So it's a very, very rapid death, because it just moves through your body and you stop making energy, and 14 seconds later, you're gone.
Whoa.
So what you want to do is you want to support those mitochondria, which may not be as healthy as they should be. You could have some innate vulnerabilities, or it might just be accumulated damage. But the mitochondria recipe, if you're ready for that, I shall give it to you. Do you have a pencil, sir? Mm-hmm. All right.
I probably don't.
All right. Yeah, well, right. Do we record this show? Is it going to be on available on the website?
I don't know. I don't plan that. They choose. But
I'll tell you where you will be able to find it.
Right.
You will be able to find it on AskDrDawn.com, but I just can't tell you. Sometime in the next month, it'll show up there in one of my podcasts, because I reuse this material. But I don't know when, and I can't tell you when to look for it. But if you email me at AskDrDawn.com, and say I'm the mitochondrial EMF guy that you talked to at KZSC, then I will send you an email when I know what podcast it's in. Okay, I'll send you a link.
Okay.
All right. But anyway, here's the recipe for anybody else who might have a pencil. CoQ10, which is coenzyme Q10, you want to take about 200 milligrams of this three times a day. Okay, D-ribose, which is a 5-carbon sugar, you want to take about 5,000 milligrams of this three times a day, and you could even take up to 10,000. It's mildly sweet. It has about 15 calories per teaspoon. It is not used as glucose. It's used to make ATP and also to make DNA, which is why it's D-ribonucleic acid. That's the ribose is the ribo in that. So anyway, It all fits together in this amazing web of life. And here we are talking about mitochondria. The last thing that is supportive to the mitochondria is something called L-carnitine and the omega-3 fatty acids. So L-carnitine is an amino acid, maybe 1,500 milligrams a day of that. And as far as the omega-3s go, you want lots of omega-3s. So fish oil, flaxseed oil, those sorts of foods are really helpful because then the membranes of the mitochondria are very fluid, and that helps them handle the little holes that get punched in them by the microwaves. Now, these holes seal up right away, but the problem is while they're open, you leak electrons and you lose some of that gradient. So it's like you roll the stone up the hill, but then you don't get to roll it all the way back down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it steals energy from your cells, and I think that's what was going on with your hand, is I think your hand was actually going into lactic production, dropping out of oxidative phosphorylation, which is what we call what the mitochondria does, and going into the bacterial thing, which is glycolysis, which starts to generate lactic acid, and also only creates six to eight molecules of ATP rather than 32.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a real thing, and I think you're probably one of the vulnerables. And looking at other sources of environmental and particularly EMF toxicity would be a really good idea.
Is there a way to find out what phenomena can be caused by these radiations, just to make sure that I'm not imagining things versus something is real? I mean, this hand phenomena, I can know that's real. The next day, I was sitting at that table for 2 hours, I felt groggy the whole day on the day after. So I thought maybe that's also from that. But it could also have been something else, of course.
It could be. If you look up, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on her last name, but her first name is Devora, D-E-V-O-R-A. And she wrote a really good popular book about this a few years back. I think if you went to Amazon and put in Devora and EMF, she'd probably pop up on the list.
Go to Bookshop Santa Cruz and ask them.
Yes, let them do the search and order it for you
exactly.
So that we can keep a small independent bookstore in town. Excellent idea.
Yeah. Hey, thank you for the call.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for taking it.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Thanks for waiting. You are on the air.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
So I had a comment for the person who just called in about the electronic sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in this class at UC Santa Cruz called the Brain Mind Consciousness class, and I can't remember his name, but there's a doctor who's from the Monterey Bay Area who specializes in that condition, and he says about 1% of people suffer from it. And he has several clients who are Silicon Valley CEOs who actually needed to get out of places with a lot of Wi-Fi and stuff, and they actually now live kind of out in the forest with maybe a direct line internet connection and no Wi-Fi. And limited cell phone service as a way to combat their electronic sensitivity.
Yeah, and I think the nice thing about wired systems is that you can shield them, so you can get far leveled inverse square law, because they're still going to put off a certain amount of field, but it's the transmission that has really upped the ante. I mean, once we started putting Wi-Fi everywhere, the amount of EMF that we were being exposed to went up by several orders of magnitude. And it's amount plus duration, and we all are just swimming in the stuff now. And it stands to reason that some individuals are not going to be able to detoxify from this. Their cells will be more adversely affected because this stuff does have biological activity. While we're on the subject, anybody with children who gives their kid their cell phone to play with, which I understand is hard not to do, please, please, airplane mode. Because the kids have soft skulls, especially the toddlers. Their skulls are so thin, and they're not shielded the way an adult brain is from this stuff. And I don't know for a fact that we aren't actually causing permanent structural changes, maybe affecting the pruning rate of the synapses. I mean, we may be doing some major stuff with these children besides just the training that having a cell phone and playing around with these games, it trains your brain differently than if you have to go upstairs and make a castle out of sticks and rocks. I that's another colossal social experiment, but it's not like we're going to go back. We'll figure out what we did long after we did it.
Maybe we all need to wear beanies that have electromagnetic shielding in it.
When someone comes up with some good shielding, but the problem is, like I said earlier, I'm not convinced that most of the commercially touted devices do anything.
Yeah. Well, so thank you for your comment on that. And then the other thing, why I originally wanted to call was the three conditions you mentioned, psoriasis, obesity, and then the other one was also inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if you're familiar with CBD. It's cannabidiol. It's a compound that's found in cannabis and hemp. And that not only helps treat Crohn's disease, it helps treat gut imbalances, but it also topically treats psoriasis. And then it also, if you consume it, it treats inflammation in the whole body. And so I actually run a company called Santa Cruz CBD, and we're selling basically products with the CBD at different health food stores around Santa Cruz. And we've had a lot of people...
Wait a minute. You're allowed...
...not needing to use these medications that are bad for your liver and stuff. And
so are you a permitted... Are you doing this just on your own? Are you permitted to do... Do you have to be permitted? And are you selling to health food stores? Are you selling to dispensaries? Where's your project available?
Dispensaries, but we're selling. New Leaf just picked us up. We're in Felton New Leaf right now, but we'll be in all the New Leafs by the end of next week. And we're at Go Ask Alice, the True Olive Connection, Pipeline Smoke Shop.
Well, I'm not up on the laws.
It's illegal because it's from European hemp, and it doesn't contain any THC in it.
Okay, so it's the hemp oil, and because it's from so hemp oil has CBD in it. This I did not know.
So we're actually taking a pure CBD, a 99.8% CBD extract, and then infusing that into either MCT, which is a fractionated coconut oil,
mm-hmm.
or
medium chain triglyceride
olive oil. Like a high antioxidant olive oil called Piquol that we get from the Olive Connection. Hmm. And so you can use that topically or orally to treat literally hundreds of different conditions. And that was one of the other questions I had for you was the way that CBD and all these other cannabinoids work is they operate on your endocannabinoid system.
Right.
And there's this compound, anandamide, which regulates your pain, your mood, your sleep, your appetite. And so what foods or practices do you know of that might support the endocannabinoid system and help boost your natural levels of anandamide?
Okay, so let me reframe.
Because that's basically what CBD does. Yeah. CBD boosts your natural levels of anandamide by inhibiting an enzyme that degrades anandamide.
Okay. Well,
oh,
go ahead.
Really? Okay. That's interesting. So, yes, I'm aware of the endocannabinoid system, and I am not specifically aware of what practices beyond the sort of obvious ones of adequate sleep, good nutrition, and stress reduction, meditation, things like that. I'm not aware of any specific nutraceuticals or other things that would increase levels of that. Thank you very much for educating me about the mechanism of CBD, because it makes a lot of sense, but I didn't really know that the mechanism had been elucidated. So I would infer, if one is claiming an immune system modulation, that cells of the immune system must also have cannabinoid receptors. Do you know this to be a fact?
You know, my business partner, Will, he actually is a biology student at UC Santa Cruz, and he knows more of the science behind it.
Okay.
I'm more of a practical cannabis guy. I know, you know.
Well,
I
you've
know
certainly been.
I know people who have been treated with diabetes cause a certain milligrams per day, and he knows why that works.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, I don't know that much more besides that there's this enzyme that breaks down anandamide, and CBD inhibits that enzyme. So what CBD increases your body's natural cannabinoid, but then THC, what it does...
You know what I'm going to ask you to do, caller?
If anandamide
you,
system.
We have a hemp show, a cannabis show here once a month. And if you would call in on that, we'll have some people who could talk to you on that on this month, and it's in 2 weeks. So why don't you call back then?
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, I appreciate your time, and thank you very much. Your show has been very educational.
Yeah, and you've helped. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And you were on the air with Dr. Don.
I just wanted to let you know that a lot of the information that the previous caller provided about cannabidiol was incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
So cannabidiol does have a DEA registration number. It's considered a controlled substance. And I know that some of the local places had put it up, and they're now pulling it off the shelves at places like the Herb Room. And the issue is around people thinking that they get it from industrial hemp or it comes from a food product and it's okay. You know, it doesn't really matter to the DEA or the FDA whether or not LSD comes from moldy bread.
Right.
It's still
okay.
LSD. And this is a problem. It's just some misinformation that's going around.
Well, there's so much information. It's so difficult. That's why we do this cannabis show once a month up here and bring in experts. Dr. Don has been on the show because she is an expert on it in many ways. And so sort of the medical end of it. And so I hope you'll call in and talk to us on that show, too.
I would love to.
All right.
See you later.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Hi there. You're on the air with Dr. Don.
Mine's probably going to be an easy question for you to answer. I got, you know, my legs are very restless at night, and you can literally see the muscle twitching,
uh-huh.
like, you know, almost constantly, even during the day.
Okay, so do you have
you know,
any do you have any spinal cord injury,
muscle.
Any history of disc disease or anything like that? Like a spinal injury or a ruptured disc or anything like that?
I recently I'm a musician. I lift a lot of instruments and didn't have, you know, I was carrying all this stuff. And one morning I woke up and I was literally paralyzed, you know, and... I couldn't get out of bed. It was the strangest kind of pain, too. I'm used to a lot of physical pain, but this was, you know, this neurological, like, sensations I'd never felt before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like running down that nerve on the outside of my leg, onto the shin, and then down. I haven't felt my big toe in about 3 years now.
Okay, yeah. Well, there's that's why you're getting the fasciculations. That's what we call them, fasciculations. It's where you see like little worms under the skin and your muscles are quivering and you're watching the individual motor units. Think about a switchboard or a wiring diagram where one wire turns on maybe, you know, six things and you're hitting all of those muscle fascicles. That's why they call it fasciculation. Now, that means the nerve is compromised. And the two big things that I think of are direct pressure from spinal cord injury, like a disc, damage to the nerve from some kind of toxin. And so one thing I would tell you, caller, is you need to check for mold exposure in your house. Because people who have mold toxicity, fasciculation is one of those weird symptoms that's kind of more characteristic of mold toxins than anything else. Now, in your case, it may just be your back injury, but I would definitely go on a mold sniff around. You know, pull up the edges of the carpeting. You know, look for mold.
Right, look for mold. I there's probably no chance of me having mold because I'm here in Santa Cruz. I rent a really nice place. I have a 1940s trailer
there's a good place for it to be.
Biodegrading and water dripping behind every part of it. And like, I think black mold would be afraid to even come in.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Because there are other molds that are, like, even worse that science has not even discovered yet.
Okay. So you may have... You may actually be getting this from mold toxins and not from your spinal injury.
No, I know. But, you know, as far as mold, of course there's mold. There's this place, you know, it's like, it's a 1940s trailer. I mean, it's probably asbestos, mold, you know.
It probably does. Hey, before you go, give a shout out for your band. What band are you in?
I'm in the John Sanders Sleepy Time Band.
Is that right? That's one of the best bands in town.
I think the fix is in here.
Yeah.
So mold toxicity, I mean, what do I do with that? Do you know?
Well, that's a huge topic, and we can only just graze the surface of it tonight, but... You find yourself some other digs, because there's nothing you can do until you reduce your exposures. It's just, start now. Start looking around for a different place that's never had any water damage, that's drier. You're not going to find anything mold-free in Northern California, because we have this lovely morning fog, and everybody's got a little mold. But... it's about the dose. And I mean, if you're getting a massive dose of this, this is not just the fasciculation. You know, that's just the visible tip of the iceberg. Toxins are poison. It'll shorten your life. And you need to reduce the toxins in your environment. And that may mean changing your, moving you, the mobile part of the equation, to a different environment.
Right. I wish I could, but, you know. No,
it's easy to find houses in this town. Cheap, nice, clean places. We won't have any problem.
I'm going to go looking for the mold.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This is a great story. Let me talk about it a little bit. So stem cells treatments have abounded throughout the planet. You can get... in an airplane and fly to China, Mexico, Argentina, Eastern Europe, and you can get stem cell treatments with embryonic stem cells. And they'll inject them into your bloodstream. They'll inject them into your spinal column. In the case of Jim Gass, he had a stroke that left him with a weak arm, and he wanted to get his arm strength back, and he had the kind of money to fly to these places. And overall, he spent over $300,000 getting stem cell treatments. And then one day after his fifth or sixth stem cell treatment, he woke up and he couldn't walk, and he was in excruciating pain, and went to the hospital, and they did an MRI, and they found a large mass growing in his spinal column. Looked like a cancer. And they then went in and did a surgery trying to see if they could remove it. They opened it up. The thing was just growing and twisting and infiltrating all the nerves. There was no way that it could possibly be resected, but they took a little sample, and it wasn't a cancer. In fact, it wasn't even Jim Goss's cells. These were de-differentiated embryologic cells that were from the stem cell treatments that he had received. And they did a cancer gene analysis of these things. No cancer genes, none of the markers that you would see for a medulloblastoma or a neuroblastoma or a glioblastoma or any of the nerve tumors. It's actually not his tumor. It's just uncontrolled growth of these stem cells that were injected into his spinal column. They were supposed to magically have cellular wisdom and migrate to the places where he had his stroke, but instead they decided to move in down there in the pelvis. And effectively, he is now paralyzed from the neck down because it grew so fast that it infiltrated his entire spinal column, kind of the Boston Ivy version of cancer. But it's not cancer. It's a medically induced tumor that we can't kill because it doesn't respond to any of the chemotherapy agents that work on cancers, because it's not a cancer.
So he's just stuck.
He is stuck. And it's a cautionary tale about this. And this is the first time there have been like two cases. I shouldn't say it's the first time, but this one's really a spectacular tumor. And everybody is studying it, and we're learning things from it, and there's articles being published and trying to understand, okay, what went wrong here? How did this happen? What could we do differently next time so that we don't have this possibility? We've always worried that this could happen. And, you know, stem cell transfusions have always creeped me out because, you know, this idea that somehow the stem cells are going to know where to go and what to differentiate into has so always struck me as wishful thinking. And at least in this case, that's what it was.
Exactly, yeah. Wow. So many interesting things go on in your field, and you keep up with a lot of
it. Well, you know, we complain about the FDA in this country, but they do keep us safe from really egregious commercial exploitation. Instead, it's only the somewhat egregious commercial exploitation of pharmaceutical companies charging out red. Yes, for the EpiPen. Let me talk real quick about this new technology. We've talked about autoimmune disease, and autoimmune disease has come in packs, it said. I saw a patient recently who has like five different autoimmune disease, and she was just diagnosed with another. And I think the one that she's got now is a result of the drugs that were being used to treat her one of her other autoimmune diseases. And I think what happened is that the drugs were too hard for her liver to handle. And so her liver had killed off a few cells, and the debris from her liver cells stimulated the immune system to start attacking the liver. So now she has autoimmune liver disease. And it's in very early stages, and of course they want to add yet another drug, and I've been working with her trying to figure out what else we might be able to do that could be a better option. But it's so interesting to think that autoimmune disease might create itself by trashing cells, and then the dead debris, the DNA and RNA from these cells, primes the immune system to attack other cells. And so it's an autocatalytic thing. And wouldn't it be nice if we could clean up that debris before it triggered the immune system? And some researchers just came up with something called nucleic acid binding polyamidoamine polymers. And they actually act like a sponge, and they scoop up broken bits of DNA and RNA from areas of cellular destruction to sequester them so that they can't stimulate the immune system. And they've been giving this now to a mouse model of lupus, which is a very bad autoimmune disease. And the cool thing about this is it's not an immunosuppressant. So they've been able to really back down on the lupus in these mouse models because they clean up all the cellular debris. So the lupus damps down rather than being accelerated by all of this debris. And they've also shown that it does not attenuate the immune system. In fact, the cells have a better immune, those mice have a better immune system than standard mice.
Well, it sort of sounds like the way they clean up the oil spills. They have sort of spongy things they throw out there and suck it up.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.